Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Ralph Wald. Ralph Wald is a naturalist and author. He spent nearly two decades working for the Nature Conservancy as an interpretive naturalist in Montana and Arizona. Now semi-retired, Ralph lives along the San Pedro River in southeastern Arizona, where he continues to speak and write on behalf of the land and its life. He's the author of a new book called The Life of the San Pedro River. This book is available through links at his blog, which is www.ralphwald.com, ralphwald.com. So first off, thank you for your work in the world, and second, thank you for being on the program.
Well, I thank you too, Derek. It's an honor to speak on behalf of the San Pedro River, and I truly appreciate this opportunity.
So where, what, and who is the San Pedro River, and what's so special and wonderful about that place?
Well, the San Pedro River is located in the southeastern corner of Arizona. In terms of what makes it so special and precious, I think the first thing to consider is that we have a river here that is flowing through a desert. That is something rare in itself, and any river in any desert is a gift. When I take groups out or when I give talks on this river to people, one of the things I always try to do right off the bat is to try to give them a bigger picture of this landscape. And I ask your listeners to imagine a raven's view of this part of Arizona. Imagine that you're high up in a jetliner flying above the desert, miles up in the sky. And the first time that that experience happened to me, I was flying into Tucson years and years ago, and I looked down at the landscape out the window, and what I saw was this huge ocean of desert that just stretched to the ends of every horizon. The land beneath me was wrinkled. It looked dry. It was a palette of colors that suggested that, browns and grays. There was very little green, no blue down there, and it just seemed to go on forever. And then when we flew over the San Pedro Valley, I looked out of the window again, and in that ocean of desert, there was this bright green thread coursing its way through this valley under the plain. And the sight of that river just galvanized me right then. I immediately understood what was so special about this river. It's a ribbon of green that brings life to a huge landscape that has so little water in it. So that's part of what makes it very, very special. But in terms of its life, it really stands out. The biological richness of this watershed is unparalleled anywhere in the United States. In terms of any place I know of in this country that is of similar size, is not quite as rich as this one. There's over 450 species of birds that have been recorded within the watershed of this river. 90 native mammals live here, and that's an incredible number. I don't know of any other similar-sized inland area in North America that has such a richness in its native mammalian fauna. And we've got 80 reptiles and amphibians living here. That also is a very high number in terms of anywhere in the United States. And the floral richness of this river and the watershed is amazing because we have a lot of overlap here in terms of its ecology. One other thing that really stands out in terms of the river's watershed and its position in the world is that the San Pedro River is in a biogeographic overlap zone. In other words, four major ecoregions overlap here. And for your listeners to understand what an ecoregion is, they're typically large areas, and an ecoregion is normally defined by a combination of its geography and the distinct communities of plants and animals that live on it. So here in the San Pedro watershed, we have plants and animals that are unique residents of the northern Sierra Madre Mountains in Mexico. And that ecoregion reaches its northern tip right in this watershed. So it it gives us animals like jaguars and ocelots and coatimundis, for example, that you can't find anywhere else. And then we get flora and fauna from the Rocky Mountain ecoregion reaching its southern limits right here in this watershed. And in addition to that, two great deserts combine and join here, the Chihuahuan and the Sonoran deserts. And they give us also unique plants and animals. So with all that overlapping happening right here, it produces a landscape that is just incredibly rich with life and diversity.
So how long is the San Pedro, and that ribbon that you're talking about how wide is that before you graduate back into desert?
The river is about 165 miles long. It actually heads in Sonora, Mexico, flows through Sonora for maybe 15 to 20 miles, and then enters the United States and runs through Arizona another 150, 40 or so, and joins with the Gila River eventually. And I forgot, what was the rest of your question?
How wide is that green ribbon?
The ribbon varies. It's pretty narrow. In some places, it doesn't exist. It's not continuous because the river has stretches of perennial flow and stretches that remain dry other than in flood season in the monsoon in summer. But the patches of forest that line the riverbanks can be anywhere from a few hundred feet wide to more than a half a mile or more wide.
So that, I know we're sort of heading into a thicket here, but that also sort of creates a sort of island ecology situation, doesn't it?
In a sense, it does, yeah. But most of the animals that live here are able to move back and forth between those patches if and when they need to.
Okay, so let's talk about, you've talked about a couple of the animals. Let's talk about a few more animals. There's a history of beavers there. And who else are some of, let's go through, do you want to go big to small or small to big? Let's go small to big. So who are some of the sort of foundations of the and talk about plants too. Who are some of the foundations of the food chain? And then let's move up to the megafauna.
Okay. Well, right now I'm looking out my window into a mesquite bosque. Bosque is Spanish word for forest or woodland. And in terms of some of the most important plants that grace this ecosystem, the velvet mesquite is certainly one of them. It's really common. It's spread throughout the river bottom, and it also occurs on a lot of the upland slopes. And down here in the valley floor where I'm living, these trees can get up to 60 feet tall. They're just magnificent. But what's important about them is the food that they produce for the wildlife here. They produce crops of beans that fall to the ground by the millions every year. And literally almost everything that lives on this landscape feeds on those pods. They've got really high caloric value per unit weight. And also per unit weight, they're very high in protein and in fats. So it's a rich food source. The bears eat them. The deer eat them. The raccoons, the coyotes, the four species of skunks we have here, it just goes on and on. Literally everything feeds on that stuff. And it starts down at the bottom of the food chain, too, with all of the, or not all, but many of the small rodents that live here. They feed on those pods a lot, and those pods carry them through the year.
So I don't know desert biomes very much. When you say rodents, and we've all heard of kangaroo rats. Are there kangaroo rats? What sort of rodents are there?
Yeah, there's several species of kangaroo rats here, and there's just an amazing number of small rodents in this ecosystem. Many different kinds of mice, for example, several different kinds of native wood rats. And again, those are animals that provide food for, you know, a long list of other animals in the food chain. And they also have really important effects on the ecosystems that they live in. They gather and disperse seeds, and thus they become a real important component of the workings of the plant communities. They also dig holes everywhere they live, and that's really a big thing in a place like this hot desert environment. The holes, they give them shelter, but they also can provide shelter for other animals that use them once they're abandoned, snakes and lizards and so forth.
I know this is an entirely different biome, but I remember reading that the gopher tortoise of the southeastern United States digs these huge tunnels, which is extraordinary enough in itself, but there are, like, I don't remember the numbers, like 80 different species use their burrows, you know, from insects to amphibians to rodents, use their burrows. And I'm guessing it's a lot like that, that they, that a lot of other species end up using the abandoned ones.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's really crucial component of this ecosystem's workings. And not just with the mice and the smaller rodents, but all the way through anything that tends to dig a burrow here. And one of the things I thought of immediately when you were talking about the tortoises over in the southeast is we have Sonoran desert tortoises here. They get quite large, and they can drill holes down into the earth that are 10, 12 inches wide and go quite deep. And those holes, of course, last for a long time. The turtles use them, and other animals use them. There's another animal here that is really a big part of the ecology of the valley flora, and that's an animal called a pocket gopher. And they're like moles, but we don't have moles in Arizona. We just have pocket gophers. They live underground their whole lives, and they dig and dig and dig. That's all they do. And as they dig, they create a network of underground tunnels throughout the valley floor. And those tunnels provide refuge for many of our amphibians that live here. They provide wintering quarters for some of our lizards and snakes. They also provide a way for rainfall to percolate more readily and more deeply into the soil layers here. And they facilitate the exchange of gases in and out of the soil. The pocket gophers really do a number here. They're a really beneficial species. And by their digging, they also tend to move a lot of soil from lower horizons up to the surface. And by doing that, they mix the soil, and that also helps keep the soil porous and fertile. And they're really important mammals.
And I'm guessing, too, that they provide a lot of food. I have a very dear friend who absolutely loves and works to defend prairie dogs. And I say that because some of the language she uses, this could be deemed disrespectful, except she absolutely loves them. She also calls them nature's candy bars because because everybody eats prairie dogs. And yeah. And I'm guessing it's the same for the pocket gophers.
Yeah, yeah, they do wind up feeding a lot of creatures here. There are some snakes here that are specialized to get into their burrows, most notably one that's called the gopher snake. Owls feed on them regularly, and I've watched bobcats take them, coyotes, gray foxes, all sorts of animals.
So in a few questions, I want to delve into your absolutely beautiful book. But before we do that, I have a few more basic questions. And I guess I'll just list out the questions first. And later on, I want to talk about threats to it, too, but not yet. So first, can you talk about fish? Because we haven't really mentioned fish yet. Second, can you talk about birds? Because you mentioned birds and a flyway before. So can you talk about fish and birds first, and then I want to ask you about your book.
Yeah. The fish here, boy, that is a situation that's really changed in the last century. There used to be a lot more perennial flow in the San Pedro River and also in some of the other streams and rivers in this region. And those waterways, of course, held native fish. In the last century, so much of them have dried up or just gone under that the few native fish that we have left are relegated to just a few high streams in the mountain drainages, in the mountain areas, rather. And they're small, but they're unique to this area. They don't live anywhere else in the world. in terms of the birds.
Wait. Before we leave the fish, so are you saying the San Pedro itself doesn't really have many fish because it goes dry?
No. What I'm saying is the rare fish, the ones that are really unique here that you don't find anywhere else, are confined to just a few waterways where there's perennial flow, and those happen to be some streams up in the mountains.
Okay.
The river itself has perennial flow stretches, one of which is well over 20 miles long, and then many others scattered along its length of varying length. But in those stretches, there are native fish, but they're not particularly rare. One of them is one of the dace, and then there's not a whole lot else in terms of the fish there. There are some non-native fish that have become established in a few of those areas.
So one more question about fish and water flow before we move to the birds, which is, so when you talk about a reduction in flow, was the San Pedro a year-round river prior to conquest?
As far as we know, yes. But the historical records that go back to the time when Europeans were just starting to enter this part of North America are few and far between. We have very little reliable data from back then, but the data we do have strongly suggests that, yes, indeed, it was flowing along its entire length or along nearly all of its length.
Okay, so let's talk about birds.
Yeah. The richness here is incredible. This corner of Arizona is a mecca for bird watchers. People come from all over the nation and all over the world to watch birds here. And the reason is simply that there's such a richness, and a lot of the species that live here you can't see in the United States anywhere but here. So it really draws people. But the river, when you connect the river to the lives of birds, there's an inseparable bond there that's incredibly important to bird life. The river flows in a north-south direction, and that's something that's really important. Imagine all of the migrating songbirds coming up north through Mexico every spring on their way to their nesting grounds in the United States and Canada. Those birds, many of those species, tend to travel through and over the Sierra Madre Mountains, and when they reach the border here, they tend to get funneled by geography into this river valley. And before them is 165 miles of river with many, many patches of forest and water available for them. And the river furnishes these huge numbers of migrating songbirds with a place to rest and refuel on their migration trips. And for the birds, it's utterly critical. They're flying through an immensity of desert, through much of Mexico and on into the desert southwest here. And if they don't have those links where they can stop to rest and refuel, they don't make their journeys. And this river, as far as I know, anywhere between Southern California and probably Texas, this has got to be the most important inland flyway for songbirds. Millions of them funnel through this river every spring. And when you go down into the river bottom in any time in mid to late April or early May, it is just alive with all these different songbirds coming through.
And so before we go to your book again, when you talk about them refueling, them eating, does that mean that there is a great abundance of insects in the region too? Because we haven't really mentioned insects yet.
Yeah. The river itself, you know, the riparian forests and the river form a habitat that is just rich with insect life, just loaded with insects. And the birds know that. So they come down and they need that river bottom for water. They need it for shade so that they can stay cool and rest without overheating. And they desperately and definitively need it for food, too. And they can find all of that there.
So who are some of the primary local insect populations?
The insects that really characterize this ecosystem fall into a couple of categories, and that's ants and termites. Ants are pivotal to everything that goes on here, and there are many, many species, and they do all kinds of different, they fill all kinds of different niches in the ecosystem. And the termites are really important in this desert ecosystem for decomposition, for taking plant material and breaking it down into its constituent parts so that it can be recycled into the soil.
You know, this is a little bit off topic, but I love that whole topic of decomposition and of seeing how nature has developed different tools for it in different places. Where I live, which is coastal rainforest, redwood rainforest in Northern California, the primary decomposers are fungus, secondarily slugs. And then in other places, it ends up, I mean, nature has come up with different tools for the same task elsewhere. And what you're saying is that they're one of the primary vegetative decomposers is termites. And as long as we're on the subject, who are some of the primary animal decomposers?
Not quite sure what you mean. Oh, you mean in terms of recycling plant materials and so forth?
No, you got the termites are doing plant materials. Who recycles animal materials there?
I'm not quite sure. I'm following your question.
I'm just asking who are some of the primary scavengers on animals? That's what I'm asking.
Oh, okay. Okay. Now I got you. Turkey vultures are abundant here, and they're definitely an important scavenger all throughout this ecosystem. They're really talented at finding carcasses. One of the few birds in the world that finds much of its food through a sense of smell.
Yeah, you know, I just interviewed somebody about California condors, and this is off topic, but I love this, that turkey vultures have a great sense of smell. California condors don't. So what California condors do is they fly above the turkey vultures and watch them.
Yes. That is a really interesting facet of those two birds co-evolving together through time. That is a really interesting fact.
So let's talk about your book, which is, I think, absolutely beautiful and I think really important. And it's The Life of the San Pedro River, a naturalist account of an iconic desert river and its watershed. So when did you write it? How did you write it? Why did you write it?
I wrote it mostly in 2019 and on into 2020. I spent about 17 months working on this project, and it was a long haul. I spent so much time at my desk day after day working through it. I wanted it to be accurate. I wanted it to be well-researched, and most of all, I wanted it to be a joy to read. There are other books that have been written about this river, and only one of them really comes close to resembling this in any way, and it's a great book. It's called Ecology and Conservation of the San Pedro River. But it's also a very, very different book to read because it is a compilation of scientific papers written by agency personnel and professors and the like. And so it's a great tool. It's a really good reference book, and there's a lot of really good people that contributed to it. But it's not for the average person to read. It's more for professionals. This book, I wrote this specifically so that, first of all, anyone could read it and enjoy it. And that goes from kids in school all the way up through professional biologists. I wrote it for one purpose, and that was very simply to help protect this river and its watershed, and I dearly hope it can assist in that fight. I really have grown to love this place very deeply. I've only lived here for 2 decades now, but during that time, I've gotten closer and closer to this land, and it's every time I go out, I learn something new about this place, and my appreciation and respect for it deepens. So I really hope that this book can get out there and get read. It's self-published, so not many people are going to be aware of it in terms of it getting a lot of publicity. But if it can just get passed from one to another and people read it, it can do some good. The other purpose I wrote this book for was to help educate its readers about this place and about why it's so important to protect it, and also about what is threatening it and what the future might hold and so forth.
So before we talk about threats to the place, can you tell a couple, three of your favorite stories from the book? I'm thinking about there's one you discuss, the Raven's courtship display, or any other of the wonderful stories that will partly, I just want people to help them fall in love with the river, and then also to show the difference you're meaning between this and sort of a scientific paper on the river. So can you tell a couple, three of your favorite stories from the book?
Yeah. I think one of them would be the story or the essay that I wrote about jaguars. Jaguars are incredible, magnificent, beautiful animals. And before European colonists came to this part of the desert Southwest, their natural range extended all the way through Arizona up to the Grand Canyon. And it extended into much of New Mexico and also a good-sized portion of southern Texas. In the last few hundred years, those cats have been poisoned, shot, and driven out to the point of extinction so that they no longer existed anywhere north of the U.S.-Mexico border. But in recent years, during the past few decades, jaguars have been making their way up through the Sierra Madre Mountains, where they are native species, and getting into Arizona and very rarely into New Mexico. That is a magic species. It's a magic animal. It is just an incredible creature. And while I have never seen one here, I am certain that I have found their tracks on at least two or three occasions when I've been wandering the wild places here. And so they're here. Their presence is almost like a ghost because there are so few of them. But that would definitely be one of my favorite parts of the book, just because it's such an evocative, special creature and so rare.
So I don't know if listeners have, but I've certainly seen a lot of bear tracks. How big, black bear tracks? How big is a jaguar track compared to a bear track, or compared to a wolf track?
Compared to the wolves that I've seen in the Northern Rockies, I'm thinking they're about the same as an adult male wolf. Good God, four and three quarter inches broad on an adult male.
That's great.
Big tracks and distinctive. They're different from cougar tracks. Both those cats live here, and mountain lions have very similar sized feet, but their tracks have distinguishing characteristics that make them different from jaguars.
So when you have seen the jaguar tracks, like, where have you seen them? By which I mean, do you see them next to the river, or are they more out in the open?
I have seen them in soft sediment and mud down in the river bottom.
Okay. So what's another story from the book?
Oh, boy. I don't know. There's a lot of good ones, and a lot of them I have really, really fond memories of. Something that comes to my mind right away is the first Gila monster I ever saw. I wrote about Gila monsters in the book, and they're one of those really iconic creatures that sort of define the American Southwest for a lot of people. That was an animal that I really wanted to see when I first started coming down here. And it was probably at the top of my want list, next to something that was even more impossible, which was a jaguar. But it took some time to see one in the wild, and when I finally did, I was just so thrilled. I was walking down a dry stretch of the river with a fellow biologist one afternoon. It was quite hot that day. It was late May. And we could see a long ways down this particular reach of the river. It was just dry sand. And about 100 yards ahead of us, I saw this animal come out of the forest on the right side of the river and drop into the riverbed and begin to cross the riverbed, and I knew immediately that it was a Gila monster. So we sprinted up there all the way through the sand to this animal because we didn't want it to cross and get back into the brush and disappear. We wanted to have a look at it. And we caught up with it. It was a good-sized adult, maybe 17 inches in length, chunky, healthy-looking animal, and just so fascinating. I was really happy to see that. And we positioned ourselves on either side of this big lizard, and it realized immediately that it was sort of cornered, and it stopped moving, and it took in a big gulp of air. It puffed its body up, and then it raised its head up and looked right at me and opened its mouth, revealing a purple-black inside and this long forked tongue. And it just stood there saying, in so many ways, I dare you. we stared at it and marveled for a few seconds, and then I knew we were stressing it out, so we backed off, and the lizard crawled up into the forest on the other side of the river and resumed its journey.
That's great. So at the risk of being too self-indulgent on my part, can you tell, I love these stories, can you tell one more, and then we'll move on?
Yeah. I'm trying to think of what would be a nice one. You know, we haven't touched on plants, and one of the things that I really had a delight writing about was a very special cactus that grows here. It's known by several different names, one of which is the Queen of the Night, Reina de la Noche in Spanish. Another name for it is Night Blooming Cereus, and it is a plant that defies the imagination. When I first encountered it, I was out with a coworker, and she pointed it out to me. And when she did, I had a hard time seeing it at first. The plant is a cactus, and its above ground parts consist of these long, thin, little wispy stems, maybe the diameter of your thumb or a little bit bigger. They tend to weave their way through mesquite bushes or other shrubs. And they hide because you just don't see them. They're long, thin, wispy little things. And my colleague that day pointed those out to me, and she said, you know, this is the Queen of the Night cactus. This is a really cool plant. And I looked and looked, and I thought, good God, that thing, it looks almost dead, you know, gaunt and shriveled, and just not much there. But I came to learn later on that, for one thing, most of that plant is hiding underground, and it can have tubers that can exceed 50 pounds in weight. So the plant sits underground in this hot desert environment, and it waits for the right conditions to happen. And when conditions are favorable, each plant will put out blossoms. And what's cool about this is the blossoms are huge. They're really beautiful. They're brilliant white with a multitude of petals. One whiff of them will send you into another world. The perfume these things put out is incredible. And what's really amazing about them is these Queen of the Night cacti bloom on one night of the year. And in a given region, typically all of the plants will bloom on that night. They'll put out this gorgeous, huge flower beaming in the moonlight. And I've walked out into the surrounding foothills here and found these plants blooming at night, and they have a relationship with pollinators that is crucial to their survival, because of course without pollination they can't have any progeny. So they put these flowers out and they waft this amazing strong perfume into the air, and lo and behold, they pull in pollinators like you're pulling them in on a string. And their primary pollinators are hawk moths or sphinx moths. They're large moths, maybe 3-4 inch wingspan. They come whirring along the ground, and when they find these cactuses, they'll do an about face and follow the odor trail right into the blooms. And the blooms are white not by accident. They are intended to be pollinated by night flying creatures. And if you put out a flower that's white at night, you're going to get the visual attention of those pollinators much better than any other color. So the moths zoom in, they see them, they smell them, And then they unfurl this incredible tongue upwards of 4 or 5 inches in length that comes out of the front of the moth and drops down into the flower to get a nectar reward. And as they do that, their snouts and their tongues pick up bits of pollen, and then they transfer it to another plant, and the cycle is complete.
That's great. I guess two more questions about local ecology before we talk about threats. One of them is, you just mentioned pollinators, and when you first started talking about that plant, I don't know why, I was guessing that you were going to talk about a bat pollinator because they pollinate some things, but you didn't. But we haven't talked about bats. So are there a lot of bats there or not many bats there? Do you have any bat stories?
There are a lot of bats here. I believe we have the second richest bat fauna in the entire United States. I think there's some parts of far southern Texas that might have a couple more species than we do. But if I remember the number right, I think we've got 28 bats here, and that's pretty amazing. Where I grew up in the northern Rockies, we had maybe 5 or 6. But down here, there's many different kinds, and a number of them are very, very specialized, really interesting mammals. We have a couple of migratory species that come up from Sonora, Mexico, into this desert every spring and summer, and they are the long-tongued bats. One of them is an endangered species. It's known as the lesser long-tongued bat. But they fly in multitudes, and their purpose or their goal is to find sources of food, which really special plants provide them with here. And one of the first ones that comes to mind is maybe the most iconic plant in the whole desert southwest, and that's the saguaro cactus. Saguaros put out clumps of large white flowers, somewhat similar to the queen of the night flowers I was describing. And they put these flowers up on the tips of their arms and the very highest part of the column. So they're way up in the air. They're aimed upwards. They're white. And the bats see them from a long ways away and can find them quite easily in moonlight or starlight. And they also put out fragrance to attract the bats. And then there's a number of other plants that have evolved here to do the same sort of strategy. There's a lot of agave plants growing in this part of the world. Some of them are known as century plants. They put flowering stalks up upwards of 16, 18 feet tall, and again, adorn the tops of those stalks with very light-colored, creamy white flowers. And just like the saguaro, they're targeting these special pollinators that operate up at those levels, like bats, for example. And the bats feed on them a lot, and they help those plants pollinate and keep their progeny going. That relationship between tall columnar cacti and tall agave plants with bats has been something I think it's been a great example of coevolution. For example, a cactus and a bat co-evolving through time to adapt to one another. The bat being adapted to that kind of feeding with a very special long tongue that can penetrate these flowers and get at the nectar they want. And then the plant responding to the bat by growing big white flowers up on tall stalks, just as if they were literally holding their hand out and saying, "Here it is."
That's really beautiful. Go ahead.
It's a beautiful interrelationship. And I might add that these plants that I'm mentioning, they're not just pollinated by bats. They also get pollinated by moths and beetles and a host of other insects, both in the daytime hours and at night. And in the daylight hours, there's quite a few different birds that pollinate saguaros here. And so there's a lot of those interrelationships, too, between the fauna and the flora.
That's great. Thank you for that. So one more question, and this is just because I grew up in Colorado and fell in love with cottonwoods. Are there cottonwoods there? And if so, can you just give a little love story about cottonwoods?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There's a cottonwood native here called Fremont cottonwood, And that is the primary tree that, that forms the bands of green along the banks of the San Pedro River. It's a keystone species along the banks of the river. And it's, good God, there's just so much to say about cottonwoods. There is an essay in my book about them. But they're so important in so many ways. You know, they shade that river, and that's something important to consider. When you think about the heat here and also the very, very dry conditions that persist throughout most of the year, if that river were not shaded along the stretches where it has perennial flow, I don't have much doubt that it would simply evaporate and dry up and be no more. The cottonwoods, they can rise to heights of upwards of 90 feet here, and they grow incredibly quick. They provide all that shelter and resting and insect food for the numbers of migrating songbirds. And they also provide really important nesting sites for a number of other birds that would not be here and not nest here were it not for those trees. Cottonwoods are just incredible. They characterize streams all over the American West, and they're disappearing from a lot of our rivers and streams because we've dammed those streams. And the cottonwoods are a special group of trees that that cannot really reproduce successfully unless they have flooding rivers, unless floods are allowed to flow down rivers. Their seeds, which are viable only a short time after they leave the trees in the springtime, they have special germination requirements. They're tiny little things, and if they don't fall on an open patch of ground that is porous and wet, in other words, a freshly created sandbar, a freshly created gravel bar after a flood, substrate like that, if they don't have that, they probably won't survive. So when we stop flooding on our rivers, we also stop the reproduction of cottonwood trees downstream of our dams because they can't do it anymore. So typically what happens is once a dam gets put up on a river with cottonwoods, the cottonwoods downstream of the dam get bigger and bigger and older, and then they eventually die off, and there's no young ones to take their place. So the health of the forest there is seriously compromised. Here on the San Pedro, there's a real different story because one of the great things about this stream is that it is undammed. It is a free-flowing stream along all of its length, and that allows this river to flood and to continue to replenish these cottonwood forests so the ecology stays in a good state of health relative to a lot of other rivers.
So we have about 8 or 9 minutes left. Can you talk for a moment about threats to the river and not only threats to the river, but also you said that one of the reasons you wrote the book is to protect the river. So can you talk about that?
Yeah, in terms of threats to the river, there's a lot of things that are threatening this river right now. But in order to understand them, I think your listeners need to understand something that's of fundamental importance with respect to this particular river. It's not a stream like most of us know rivers to be. A river is a stream that gets fed by tributaries, and those tributaries run into it all the time, and the river always flows, and that's what we think of when we think of the word river. This one's quite different. It's a desert river, and it flows in places year-round only where the groundwater, in other words, the water table in the soil, is high enough to reach it. And so what I'm trying to say is there are no tributaries feeding the San Pedro most of the year, and the perennial stretches are an expression of the water table. So if the water table is high enough in the valley, it will reach the point where it gets into the riverbanks and creates the river, literally. The river is an expression of the aquifer here, the groundwater. And what threatens the river is groundwater pumping by people. We all understand that people have to have water to live, but in this watershed, all of the human need for water is obtained through wells. So all the cities, everybody everywhere has to have a well, and that tends to draw those aquifers down. And when they sink low enough, the river will disappear here and disappear there, and it'll be no more. There are some real strong threats to it in terms of drawing that groundwater down to the point where the river dries up completely. And the one that comes first and foremost to my mind is a gigantic housing development that is slated to be built near the town of Benson, which is not far from where I'm living. It's a development known by the name of Vigneto. They propose to increase our population here by 70,000 people. That would would almost double the number of people that live in the watershed now. And to supply a huge development like that with tens of thousands of new homes, including golf courses, ponds, lakes, and all the other things that they have planned for this, I have no doubt that it would kill the river downstream and just it would be gone. So that's one of the huge threats. And the other threats are many, but that one looms first and foremost. People have to really learn that when we draw water out of aquifers, they don't get replaced rapidly in most situations, and this place is no exception. Some of these aquifers have taken thousands of years to build up beneath these valleys, and when we suck them dry, we leave nothing for our children, and we also leave nothing for the river and all the life that depends on it.
So is the development a done deal, or is it possible to oppose it, and are there groups opposing it?
There are groups opposing it. There is a lawsuit pending right now. It is not a done deal, and thanks to the fact that we have a new administration in the White House, I think there's a real chance that this horrendous development will not happen.
You don't have to if you don't want, but can you name any of the groups that are opposing it so that if somebody wants to get involved, either locally or somebody wants to contribute from somewhere far away somehow, that they can?
Yes. I think the primary player in this right now is the Center for Biological Diversity. And they're a great organization that does a lot of important work all over the country.
Maybe I can interview somebody from Center for Biological Diversity specifically about that project, now that you've laid the groundwork.
Yes, and I could give you a few recommendations for who to speak with.
Great, let's do that after we are done recording. Mm-hmm. So we have just a couple minutes left, and are there any... Oh, I know a question I've wanted to ask. You mentioned cottonwoods as keystone species. Can you name some of the keystone species, plants, animals, whomever, of the river? Some of the other really important. Like, if we're going to talk about the plains, we got to talk about buffalo and we got to talk about prairie dogs. If we're going to talk about Yellowstone, we got to talk about wolves, we got to talk about et cetera, et cetera. So who are some of the keystone species that just make the place?
Well, if we just talk about things that make the place as opposed to what a biological definition of a keystone species would be, that's two different things.
You can answer both. But,
okay. I will give it a whirl. Keystone species here certainly has to be velvet mesquite. Some of the others, one of the ones that I consider a keystone species because of the strong role it plays in the ecosystem are the pocket gophers. Beavers would be a very important keystone species on the river because of their impacts to the land and its life, all of which are very positive, by the way. Some of the other keystone animals here, or at least ones that are evocative and iconic to this region, are certainly the desert tortoises, Gila monsters. We have 9 species of rattlesnakes in this drainage. That's an amazing thing. Those come to mind right away. And also some of the rare birds that find refuge here, like the southwestern willow flycatcher and yellow-billed cuckoo.
So I got one more question before we go back to your book and then we finish. And that's, so what would be a species that somebody not from the region would go, oh my gosh, it made my year to see that species, but you see all the time. Like here, I mean, I see redwoods every day. People can go, oh my gosh, redwoods are amazing. I'm like, yeah, it's another redwood. That's great. I mean, I love it here. That's why I live here. But still, it's an everyday occurrence. And the same with bears. I see bears literally every day. So who are a couple species that might thrill people that you, I'm not saying take for granted, but that you have the joy of seeing every day and it becomes a normal part of your life? Do you see what I'm asking?
Yeah. You know, one of the things that is really characteristic of this river valley are vermilion flycatchers. And I'm literally looking at a gorgeous male right out my window as I speak to you right now. That's a small bird with a whole lot of color, just a blazing statement of red and crimson and scarlet. And their range is pretty limited in the United States, so they only occur down here in southern Arizona and I believe parts of New Mexico. That little character jumps to mind right away. And I think one of the other things that really defines this landscape to me are the rattlesnakes that live here. I recall grizzly bears defining the landscapes I wandered in Montana for so many years. Here, one of those things that is similar in some ways because you always have to be aware and cautious are the rattlesnakes, and they're very, very common down here.
So if you went for a walk, you might see a rattlesnake, and it might not even be worth commenting on because you see them fairly often.
Yeah, but I would definitely comment on it because it's a fascinating animal with a really interesting biology and some interesting ecology to it.
Yeah. I've interviewed somebody who does specifically about protecting rattlesnakes. That's her thing. It's really great. Okay, so can you tell people one more time how they can find out more about your work? And also, can you just talk about your book for another 20 seconds?
Sure. Well, the book is available in several different editions just different editions. Amazon sells one of the editions. Barnes & Noble has some. Those books are printed on poor quality paper, and the images are not too crisp, and the colors are not that good. There's a third option for people, and that's the deluxe edition of my book. It's printed on much nicer glossy paper, and the color and the clarity is just a league above those others. And it's just a few dollars more. But you can find links to all of those sources for my book at ralphwalt.com, ralphwalt.com.
Well, thank you so much for your work in the world, and thank you for being on the program. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Ralph Walt. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.